If the association for homeschooling, they've got about 5 representatives here. It was Ackerman. Am I pronouncing it?
Ackerman.
Ackerman, Donnelly, Rademeyer, Hanekom.
Unfortunately, the hostility to home education has not died,
and it was recommended that homeschooling not be allowed except in extreme medical situations. This led the association, backed by the HSLDA, launching a campaign for the inclusion of homeschooling in what became the South African Schools Act. It was, however, evident to the association by the use of the hostility towards homeschooling by the education authorities that there was a need for an organisation to defend and expand the rights of families to homeschool, and so we initiated the creation of the Pestalozzi Trust as a separate organisation in 1998. Since that time, the association has played an active role in engaging with government. I think I have the next slide. In Section 39 of the South African Bill of Rights, when interpreting the Bill of Rights, the courts were instructed that they must consider international law and may consider foreign law. Some of the key international law instruments that we have ratified are listed on the slide. I'm therefore handing over to Dr. Donnelly, who will present on the current state of the international law that the committee needs to be aware of and the best practice from the USA. Thank you.
Thank you, Mariki, and to the Homeschooling Association of South Africa for the fine work that it has been doing. Thank you, Madam Chair, and this Honorable Committee for allowing me to appear before you today to share thoughts about this important issue. South Africa is among the world's leading democracies. The deliberations that you undertake here will not only affect people in South Africa, but other people in Africa and in other countries around the world. I just want to say that I'm not here to tell you what to do, but rather to share experience, perspective, and information that I hope you'll find helpful. HSLDA is the world's largest home education association in the world, with over 100,000 member families in 36 countries. We were founded in 1983. We serve primarily families in the United States, but as Ricky noted, we help other organizations and other families around the world. And our mission is to help make homeschooling possible for anyone, everywhere, or anywhere. I have the privilege to visit over 30 countries to meet policymakers like yourselves and home educating parents, including in East and West Africa and South Africa. We speak different languages. We have different religious, cultural, philosophical traditions, even different geographical and developmental realities. But one thing I have noticed in my travels is that no matter where I go, parents love their children. And this truth inspires them to stretch themselves and their resources to give their children, to give our children, an education to help them achieve their potential and to help contribute to society. We have to admit, as the principal mentioned earlier, there are exceptions. We live in a fallen world, and there is a role for the state to protect children from harm. But policy needs to be based on data and foundational principles and presumptions. So I'd like to address 2 points in my brief remarks. First, although our American experience may be different from your experience here in South Africa, I believe our experience can be useful to you. And I believe that my study of international human rights law in this particular context will help illuminate how you can think about it in this context also. Can I have the next slide? Mr. Long. Oh, and that's, yeah, you can go back one. I haven't seen them for a couple of days. It's nice to see them there. My family of 7, I am a homeschooling parent. Next slide, please. Thank you, sir. And if you want to get in contact with me, of course, members of the committee, you will have these slides. Next slide, please. The late Justice Ruth Bader Ginsburg, an Associate Justice of the United States Supreme Court, once observed that the South African Constitution was a great piece of work. And referring to Section 39 of the South African Bill of Rights, she was impressed with South Africa's willingness to learn from the human rights experiences of other countries. I noticed this morning as I came in to the Parliament's building, I think this building, that your emblem has the words, "We the People," on it. I was struck by that because those are the 3 words that begin our Constitution in the United States. We the people of the United States of America do hereby ordain and establish this Constitution of the United States of America. And I believe that these shared values of self-determination and fundamental freedoms represented in those words, we the people, are instructed here today. We fought our war for independence in 1776, and later a bloody civil war over the issue of slavery, and in the ensuing civil rights struggle. Such struggles for freedom here, for you, have been more recent and no less momentous. You know what it means to struggle for freedom and for self-determination. You know what it means to face a hostile culture and a legal system that says, no, you may not. To have agents of the state threaten and coerce and say, no, the law doesn't allow it. Today in the United States, we have the world's largest home education population, but it was not always this way. The pioneers of our movement, as referenced, even the pioneers of this movement here in South Africa, struggled against a hostile culture, an entrenched bureaucracy, and a legal culture that said, no, you may not. Now, although home education in our country dwindled after the introduction of coerced school attendance in 1852, which is when it started, with, in 1980, only 6 of our 50 states explicitly recognizing the practice of home education, 1980, 6 of 50, a revival of this practice began in the 60s and 70s, and by 1996, all 50 states officially recognized the practice of home education in law. During the about 42 years or so of the modern home education movement, the population of this movement has grown from a few thousand to almost 6 million children in the United States. And in response to the pandemic school closures that we all experienced everywhere in the world, the numbers doubled in 2021 to about 11% of the school-age population. It's since come back to about 8% of the school-age population now as schools have reopened and we're getting back to normalcy. Hooray. Now, although compulsory school attendance at government schools, you can go ahead and page through, let's hold off on that. Let's get right there. Thank you. Although compulsory attendance at government-run schools became a standard over time in our country, historically, parents educated their children at home, on their farms, and in their shops for the first 100 to 150 years of the Republic. I think that probably happened here, too. With the industrial age came industrial education, the standardized assembly line model, which worked well, frankly, for the elite who owned these companies and wanted factory workers who were compliant citizens. But a post-industrial age demands a more sustainable and learner-centered education. And in a democratic society, we should trust our fellow citizens and allow for more individual freedoms and less state intervention. In the U.S., early legal challenges showed us how some wanted to use coerced education in government schools as an opportunity to use the state's coercive power to indoctrinate children in a particular worldview. In Pierce v. Society of Sisters, this case here, in 1925, the Supreme Court of the United States struck down a law that was supported by the Ku Klux Klan, I'm sure you've heard of that racist organization in our country, and passed by the voters of Oregon that required children to attend government schools only. And this was a landmark decision in which the court wrote, the child is not the mere creature of the state. Those who nurture him and direct his or her destiny have the right, coupled with the high duty, to recognize and prepare him for additional obligations. And while acknowledging, you can page through the next one, thank you, Will. While acknowledging that education is an important interest of the state and society, the court has consistently upheld the primary role of the family as the primary decision maker in the roles in the lives of children and has carefully circumscribed the state's role in education as a bulwark against excessive control. Now, in the ensuing slides, which I recommend to you in your leisure time as you're studying this, these are numbers which show the growth of education around the United States and around the world. You can just page through that. This that last slide, let me just pop back for real quick a second. This last slide shows what happened in the pandemic and how homeschooling grew fastest in minority communities in the United States, in the Black community, in the Hispanic community, and interestingly, the U.S. Census also showed that it grew fastest among the lowest income segment of our population. Today, go ahead and page three. Today, homeschooling is growing around the world with the top 10 or so countries, including us, of course, the United States, but the United Kingdom, Russia, Canada, South Africa, where we are today, Brazil, France, Colombia, Mexico, the Philippines, and Australia, and many other countries. In fact, it's growing in Africa, too, and there are growing homeschooling populations in Kenya, Namibia, Uganda, and other places. Now, I would suggest to you, I'm not sure what the next slide is, but let's see what it is. Okay, right there, yes. The USA has been an ideal laboratory for testing the different regulatory frameworks on home education. We've got a large home educated community, long history, and 50 states and a federal system which have authority over the laws for education in those states, which has allowed for much experimentation, experience, and observation. What we see, and we see home education distributed across a range of socioeconomic circumstances, a mix of urban and rural environments. In my own state of West Virginia, where I live, it's a rural state with lower socioeconomic factors, and other states, Kentucky, other places that are rural, Missouri, many learners struggle with access to the internet even during the COVID-19 crisis. So in some areas in our country, we struggle with some of the challenges that may not be totally dissimilar to those with which you struggle. Home education has been scrutinized very much by policymakers and academic researchers for decades, and I want to describe two trends. Can you move on to the next slide? One more. I may have to back up a little bit. I'm sorry, I may pull a Chris on you. I'm sorry about that. Could you go forward to the next one?
Forward.
Yeah, forward. One. Yeah, keep going through this. This is just the history, and we're just going to skip right over this. You can look at this at your leisure. It's just the history of home education. Yeah, right there. Okay, thank you. So there's two trends in the United States that we've seen over the last 42 years. One, laws have moved from more restrictive to less restrictive. I mean, it makes sense when a new idea is introduced, especially where children are concerned. The state may be cautious and impose certain, maybe more regulation. But over time in our country, these states and policymakers have recognized that a less burdensome approach is as effective and consumes less state resources. Secondly, the number of states with restrictive regulatory regimes has decreased. Now, home education is different, and there's been some talk about having a one approach to regulating education. But I would encourage you to think about that, because it's a different kind of approach to education, and so I would suggest that it may need to be regulated differently. And in light of the research findings that I will share with you, that's what policymakers in our country have done. Now, most people will ask similar questions about home education. In fact, we were having some of those conversations over lunch. In fact, I remember when I first told my mother-in-law, well, I should say when my wife and I told my mother-in-law, because there was no way I was going to do that by myself, that we were going to homeschool our kids. She was more than curious. I don't have the picture, but she was skeptical, okay, and asked the same questions that I have heard today, and I've heard from thousands of others. How does it work? Can it work? Is it effective? What about socialization, right? These are the questions that homeschoolers everywhere in the world hear, and I've answered them many, many times. People wonder, how can an untrained parent possibly educate their own child? Don't teachers need training and degrees and certificates to ensure that students learn? No, they don't. And my apologies to those of you who have invested 4, 8, or more years in getting a teaching degree in education, not to undermine the relevance or the importance of that, but the research is very clear. The research is very clear, and it doesn't matter what the learning venue is. Teacher credentialing is not predictive of student learning outcomes. What it has shown is that in the home educating community in particular, they've shown that no matter what kind of an education the parent has, academic outcomes of home educated students are consistently better than their peers. That's the research, and it's cited in the previous slides. Now, in some ways, it's not really fair to compare home-educated students to others, because home education has what I would call built-in advantage. It provides an environment that's different, physically safer in many cases, most cases, delivers more academic engagement, ask me about that later, and allows parents to encourage and affirm their children. These have been found to be highly impactful variables in any educational setting that drives student outcomes. So when you find classrooms where children are thriving, look at the teacher. You found a good teacher who does these things. Not only are the results better, but the costs are lower. Policy analysis in our country shows that home education saves hundreds of billions, at least $100 billion. Yes, billion with a B, okay, across our country. Because children who would otherwise be demanding those resources are not in the school, and the parents are still paying their taxes. Social outcomes are likewise better. studies from a number of different universities, including Harvard's Flourishing Project, indicate that home-educated children have more positive attributes associated with positive socialization. So one of the most asked questions about home education is, why do people do it? Many reasons, as many reasons as there are children. The UDHR articulates education is about the full development of the human personality and to strengthen the respect for human rights and fundamental freedoms. So I think this means we should acknowledge that the best education is one that allows every person to thrive based on their unique learning capacity, personality, and ability. And so as guardians of their children's rights, home education allows parents to design and oversee an educational program that extends beyond the field of learning, extends the field of learning beyond the classroom, beyond children of their own age. Parents can provide experiences of learning with joy, not under duress. I went to public school. I know what it's like. Lots of us here did. It was okay, right? Some good experiences. But you know what I'm talking about. You talk about stress, right? So that each child can develop their individual curiosity and critical sense, where each child is respected as an individual, where learning can be aligned to their desires and impulses, to his body's needs, where the child and the family can live together according to natural learning rhythms, to benefit from different human relationships instead of undergoing what some have described as a forced course of school and artificial collectivization. Now, there's a place for us to come together in society, and we need to make it good in schools. But in a home-educating environment, children can receive special attention and care given to their own individual situation so they can develop self-awareness and self-confidence. So over the years, the research-based observations have caused policymakers in our state to remove regulatory burdens from home-educating families. That's what this slide shows. A common policy initiative has been to make notification a requirement only in many states. Only once at the beginning of home education. Why should parents have to submit, yeah, I'm still homeschooling, yep, still doing it, gonna keep doing it, you know, every year. Why? Why is that necessary? I'm home educating. I'll tell you if I stop. Okay? Another has been to remove assessment reporting requirements, something we've talked about here. Many policymakers I've spoken with observe that this is reasonable. Home educating families are not asking for anything from the state, simply to be left to educate and care for their children. This research experience explains why policymakers in our country and over about 20 states have moved in this direction. Next slide, please. And this is what our country map looks like. So the green states are those states that do not even require parents to notify any authorities at all that they're home educating. You see Texas, Alaska, Missouri, different places, New Jersey. And there are other states that also have other modes of compliance that do not require homeschooling parents to notify the authorities that they're homeschooling. In the other states, the light blue states, those are simply notice states, where the parent just sends in that one-time notice and says, appreciate the opportunity, thank you for making a school that I can take advantage of if I want to, but I'm opting out, I'm going to educate my kids. So that's what the policy map looks like. Next slide, please. And this just, I want to point this out to you, you can look at it, these are the numbers of the states that do these different approaches. Notification, and these are kind of the different criteria that you look at, and you'll find these across the world in different kinds of education regulatory frameworks for homeschooling. Is there notification, assessment, assessment reporting, whether there's reporting or not, what kinds of credentials are required by the parent, and whether there's a required curriculum or not. In the U.S., there is no required curriculum. There is no national curriculum. Different states have their own curriculum. But there is hundreds of different curriculums that we have access to in the United States. And parents can choose the curriculum or mix and match the curriculum that works best for them. There are required subjects that must be taught. So you got to teach the basics. At least 5 subjects. Some states have 8. Some have 10. But there is no mandatory curriculum. So in addition to these practical research-based observations and policy experiences, there are also some important human rights reasons I want to talk with you about that should cause you to consider how to avoid unnecessarily using the coercive power of the state in education. And the UDHR is a foundational text in the international human rights system. Now, although it's not a binding treaty, I understand that one of your justices, Mr. Albie Sachs, has likened the UDHR to a kind of international human rights common law. And as we approach this text, this may be a sensitive subject, but I feel that I have to point this out. We must remember the historical context in which it was written. The framers of the UDHR had just emerged from one of the most catastrophic conflicts in the history of the world, witnessing unspeakable horrors perpetrated by a totalitarian regime, just two of them, which had banned private education and weaponized its school system to make war. We may not ignore this reality. This is what modern human rights law was born from. We must remember this, or else we risk repeating the mistakes of the past. Next slide. You can go through the next one. Thank you. This is a book I would encourage you to potentially get some of your staff to read. In it, I explore these human rights arguments much more deeply. Next slide, please. But in the UDHR 16.3, the families recognize as a fundamental group unit of society. Society is made up of groups of families, and larger groups, too. In Africa, there are tribal groups, and there are lots of families that are together. In Article 26.3, the framers wrote that parents have a prior right to choose the kind of education that shall be given to their children. These two principles together mean that families should be able to choose home education, and that educational freedom ranks among the most significant human rights, including the right to freedom of religion, conscience, due process, and even the very right to life. It's for this reason I believe that every major human rights treaty expressly protects the rights of parents as primary decision makers relating to the education of their children. All of these contain the similar language I'm going to go through quickly. Following the UDHR, next slide, were two binding human rights treaties. I believe South Africa has ratified both of them. That establish these principles in binding international law. Article 18.4 of the ICCPR. And I would point out that this is a non-derogable right under this article, which simply means that this right, along with a few others, is ranked so highly that, according to international human rights law, the state is not allowed to stop protecting or respecting this right, even when the very life of the state is at risk, meaning when a national catastrophe strikes, or even when there's a war. That's how highly this right is ranked. The ICESCR, Article 13, demands respect for private education and for parental decision-making in education. And Werner Munoz, the Special Rapporteur on Education, next slide, wrote a report when he visited Germany, where Germany has not allowed homeschooling widely. They have repressed the right of parents to homeschool their children, and he went there and visited, and he wrote this. He said, distance learning methods and homeschooling represent valid options which could be developed in certain circumstances, bearing in mind that parents have the right to choose the appropriate type of education for their children, as stipulated in Article 13 of the ICESCR. Next slide. This same language appears in the 1960 Convention Against Discrimination. Next slide. Even in the UNCRC, although you don't see this precise language, which I frankly think is a very unfortunate oversight, but even in the UNCRC, Articles 3 and 29 recognize that there are rights and duties that the state must respect that are related to parents, and that the state should not interfere with the liberty of individuals to establish and direct educational institutions, recognizing that the state can, establish minimum standards. Next slide. The African Charter also recognizes the importance of parents making decisions regarding the religious and moral education of children, and that the family is the natural unit and basis of society. The American Convention on Human Rights also recognizes this. The European Convention on Human Rights, Article 2, Protocol 1, says the same thing, rights of parents to ensure the education and teaching in accordance with their, meaning the parents, religious and philosophical convictions. The Charter of Fundamental Rights of the European Union also recognizes this same language, also including the language of pedagogical convictions. I would like to point you to a document, which I will admit to having been a co-author of, called The Real Principles. It's available online, therealprinciples.org. And this document provides a comprehensive framework of how home education should be framed within human rights in education, starting with human dignity, and recalling principles that include the best interest of the child, the protection of the family, the impartial state, respect for difference and freedom of thought, conscience and religion, cultural rights, parental rights, and the right to education, the real principles can help you understand and contextualize this issue. I hope you will read it. South Africa has a rich tradition of considering and respecting human rights. As I pointed out, practical experience and research-based policy trends in our country and other countries as well, along with human rights law, tradition, and principles, support a careful and circumscribed role for the state when it comes to family decision-making regarding education. So in conclusion, I'd just like to make a few key points. I would urge the Honorable Committee to ensure the Bella Bill is carefully screened to ensure that home education and all provisions therein comply with the letter and spirit of these international treaties. That the committee note foreign law, such as places like the United Kingdom, Russia, Canada, and even in the United States. And finally, while the United States has the oldest modern homeschooling community, I think South Africa should be proud that it was also a pioneer globally. And interestingly, Russia too. When the Soviet Union fell in 1991, home education was placed into the law of the Russian Republic and in Ukraine and other countries in Eastern Europe, Poland also. But South Africa can be proud that it was one of the early leading countries to recognize this important right. So I urge the committee and the education authorities to work with the home education community and learn from our experience and the experience of others around the world by lessening rather than increasing regulatory burdens. This will lead to a mutually agreeable, progressive regulatory framework that will meet the interests of both the state and the parents. Thank you very much for your thoughtful consideration. It's been a very great honor for me to be here today to address the Honorable Committee. I'd be more than pleased to answer any questions you have and hear your thoughts. And I believe Ricky has some final remarks.
Thank you. The policy on home education, which is essentially the Bella Bill in practice, only mentions the Universal Declaration of Human Rights and not any of the other treaties by which we are bound as a country. The policy specifically notes that the Universal Declaration of Human Rights recognizes that parents have a prior right to choose the education of their children. We submit that the policy, which is the bill in action, as well as the bill being perceived, to practically undermine that right. In respect of the bill, in particular the rights of home education families are undermined in the following key sections. Registration. Since the Gauteng Homeschool Association already covered this to save time, I will only add that we prefer a process of notification similar to the registration of a birth, only requiring essential information. In the first instance, the forced home visit is a gross violation of the sanctity of the home, and we urge the committee to be under no illusion that you are being asked in Section 51(3) to permit this violation. While the bill says the HOD may require a home visit, in the policy on home education it is clear that each and every home is to be visited as soon as you authorise it, as in Clause 13(2). It is clearly stated that the PD shall conduct a home visit. Section 51(2)(a), Roman numeral 3, prescribes curriculum content, and this amounts to the imposition of a curriculum on the child, and this undermines the parent's prior right to choose. While this section appears to grant some freedom as the proposed program must only predominantly cover the acquisition of content and skills at least comparable to the national curriculum, this limited concession is taken away a few clauses later at Section 51(2)(b), Roman numeral 3, subparagraphs AA and BB, where the competent assessor on an annual basis will assess the learner against the standard that is not inferior to the standard determined in the national curriculum statement. The program that is approved must predominantly follow the skills and contents of the national curriculum, but then at the end of the year, the learner will be strictly assessed against the scope and sequence of CAPS. This is not saying you can do more or less what you like, but at the end of the year, we are going to assess you strictly against what we prescribe. And if the committee consults the policy on home education, you will see at Clause 18(6)(2) that a report from a competent assessor which shows that a learner has not met the minimum outcomes and standards at the end of the phase assessed by the competent assessor may provide grounds for a review of a learner's registration for home education by the HOD. Therefore, simply put, if home learners do not follow CAPS, the registration may be cancelled, and we well know that may means shall when dealing with home education. This is an imposition of a curriculum by school. It would be fairer to all if a DBE stated this openly rather than saying that under Bible we will have curriculum choice. Then that issue can be tested in the court. Next slide, please. The Association Forum could include in the committee to do the following. That when deliberating on the bill, the committee ensures that South Africa honours all its treaty commitments, not only in letter, but in spirit also, and that specifically registration be changed to notification. The Home Invasion Clause, Section 51(3) be removed from the bill. Protect the human and constitutional right of families to choose the form of education that the children receive, and to remove all requirements that learners follow CAPS. Remove the requirement to be assessed against CAPS. Assessments must respect the nature of the curriculum or approach that the learner is following. A learner cannot follow one curriculum or approach and be assessed against the adherence to the scope and sequence of another. As a former teacher, I do understand the role that assessments play in a classroom, but I urge you to consider if it has any place in a home where parents are constantly in a tutorial relationship with a child and can make necessary course adjustments as and when the need arises. Teachers, unlike parents, cannot say every learner is mastering the content and skills taught in class, and therefore rely on assessment box to determine if learners master the work. Unfortunately, this assessment usually becomes an administrative tool and seldomly offers the teacher the opportunity to review and re-engage with each learner to ensure that they have, in fact, mastered the content or the skills. It will likely be up to the learner's parents to ensure that the child receives the help, be it extra math or language lessons, when they become aware that there is a problem, usually at the end of the term when they receive the report card. By that time, learning loss has already occurred and is more difficult to remedy. In home education, on the other hand, the parents will not continue with the work unless the child mastered it. Therefore, the need for assessment as understood in the school context becomes invalid. Monitoring must be on a contingency basis and only when there is a reason to suspect educational neglect. Thank you, Chair.
No, thank you very much. Professor?
Oh my God, why has thou forsaken me? Chair, thank you very much. Let us welcome once more and appreciate.
What is the problem?
I just have to speak really.
Yeah, let's welcome and appreciate the presentation. You see, this is the beauty of living in South Africa. The beauty of living. Participatory democracy. And see, that's the beauty of it. Yeah, let me start by saying this. Where I am sitting, you see, we hear what is being said, and then we hear. It's good that we can hear. Where I'm sitting, I'm under the conviction that says, in the main, it is the responsibility, without undermining the role of parents in the education of their children. But it remains the responsibility of the state to educate her children. I'm raising this and subject to be corrected, especially from the notion of the Home Schooling Association. Being the responsibility of the state to raise and start to educate her children, I can substantiate that because, you see, there comes a time in life other than under age child, less than 18 years, gets raped, and the parents and everybody decides not to take it up. The state will pursue the case regardless. Why? That child is the subject, is a statutory rape, is the subject of the state. That's my understanding where I am, especially living in a democratic society. Maybe the question, the first question will be, what role is the government expected to play in this, so that we get it very clear. We are making an amendment on the bill that governs education here. What role, according to the homeschooling, is the state or the government expected to play? That's the first question. And number two, I saw at the recommendation there, why should the curriculum not be necessarily be standardized? Why should the curriculum not necessarily be standardized? This will just be but the remark, but I would expect a response of some kind on it. It takes a community to raise the child. I'm not quoting the Bible, I'm not quoting any of the Constitution, but I'm just quoting life. This is what life is saying to us. It takes the community to raise the child. Can I get a response on that, Jefferson? What could that be meaning? This what I'm raising. And you see, my understanding is there is a role. This is what I said, and I'm going to repeat it because I want to drive one point home. That at no stage in my life ever undermined the role of the parents in the education of their children. That's fundamentally where it is. That's why you see when kids go to school, be that at primary level, secondary, we call the teachers at those levels that they are the surrogate parents. In principle, they must build on the basis and the foundation that the parents have laid at home. If you discover that the child has got a baseless form of education, you will struggle as a teacher to bring up that child. Goes there, and then it got into the national level where education and the curriculum is being regulated in that way, in one way or the other. Until at the end of the day, now I'm bringing the issue of mutual borrowing in the education of our children. It's a principle which is being propagated by UNESCO. The principle of mutual borrowing. How do you see, when I was in the late 70s, when I was training as a teacher, I did one of the modules which was called the comparative education. How do you cross this Rubicon of comparative education in the name of UNESCO on the principle of mutual borrowing? Because you have got something good which I aspire, I've got something good which you may aspire. Then we make what we call a mutual borrowing in order to make it a point that our education for our own children is well mentored, and then we produce quality kind of persons both locally and internationally. The principle of mutual borrowing, how do you integrate that? How do you bring it to this principle, to the notion and the issue that you are talking about of homeschooling? Because I may be wrong to think that the homeschooling is only confined to the home, when in principle the opposite may be the case. But you will have to educate me. You see, you'll have to educate. I must understand what you are trying to propagate. Thank you very much, Mulu. That's you.
If I've covered you, just say I've covered
you. Jane, I'm just, while I'm sitting here listening, and we've had other Rome screening input as well, and I'm just thinking of a system where maybe accreditation can become an issue. I'm not sure. You know, some people would want nothing from the education department, don't want to follow the curriculum, they don't want to certify, and the question would often come up in if you have a grade 12 certificate from us, what do you get from homeschooling? And in South Africa, we have had many, let's call it companies or so-called accredited training facilities. But when our learners use that to go out and try and find a job, or further their studies even, that is not acknowledged. And what could be a solution to that? Because I think not everybody thinks they don't want to have a DBE accreditation. Some definitely don't want. So that's the thing.
No, thank you very much, Chair. I'm getting cold. I don't know if it's only me or I'm telling you. And when we switch off the aircon, I'm going to sleep.
I'm going to die.
I'm going to die. Chair, thank you very much for a very informative presentation. Very informative. For the first one that was done, it was more similar to the housing association. It's more similar. I had, you know, the same issues that were raising, even referring to their earlier presentation. But I appreciate the advanced presentation that we received from, you know, I forgot the name, but from the gentleman that is with us today. But I think it shows there's a bright future for, you know, for homeschooling and homeschoolers, because the research that you know was made, you know, all the information that you provided, it shows that there's a lot of work that already has been done, you know, in your country. And for us also, there's a lot of work that needs to be done, and I think maybe we're looking behind there, because when you see, you know, the depth compared to your country, you are more advanced than us here in South Africa. But there's one question that keeps on, you know, being left unanswered on, or not responded to. Maybe just to pose it again, maybe the association will also be able to respond to this. You know, you are of the view that a Bella Bill hinders with the rights and duties of the parents. Which laws, you know, you think is problematic for homeschooling, and how is it hindering for the homeschooling to progress positively or not? The second question will be, what is the negative implication of this sharing government of ours making home visits, you know, to ensure that adequate support for a child exists as a compulsory education from 3R to grade 9, that the best interest of the child is served. So that is my two clarifying questions from the Association of Homeschooling. Thank you very much, Chair.
Thank you.
No, thank you very much, Chair. Honorable Van der Walt earlier on covered me that even when you are not inside the house and the presentation was made, the good thing is that we received them on time, so we went through the presentation on time. I think I want to align myself with my colleague, Honorable Adjuan behind me. But when role players in the education system or stakeholders love what they do, they prepare well on what is it that they want to present. And when you go through your presentation again, good presentation, it gives us an insight, like I said, the Gauteng Association, it gives us an insight of what you guys go through every day. As lawmakers, sometimes we may not have the experience that you as the association have went through, because you are doing that every day. You may look at us also on TV and think this is what we do, but you may not have the experience of what we do on a daily basis. So so I respect that part, that, you know, when I want to chairperson as much as possible to understand from where you are seated, the challenges you have, the solutions that you are bringing. For me, that is the purpose of having this discussion. Your view is that parents have got the interest or the best interest of their children at heart. I agree, one part, let's pack it. But our democratic government also has the best interest of the children at heart. Maybe you may not agree. A lot of people don't seem to think government has the best interest of the children at heart. But I think from one side they do, and that is why we're also discussing this day. It's because from government point of view, they believe this changes are going to strengthen the ecosystem of the education in this country. So they, I believe, it's a point of discussion. We can discuss it out there. So that's the point I want to make. So the view that all laws and regulations are developed to advance this right of our children in this country. In your view, what is the role of the state in the education of a child? And how can the state, or how does the state sorry, ensure it plays that role, given the context of what you have presented here today? And lastly, in the how many members across the country do you have? Something one that seems probably about 900. How does the national association work? Do you have members directly affiliating to yourself, or they affiliate to provinces? So you've got the KwaZulu-Natal Association, Gauteng Association, Western Cape, and all of them, they form part of your of your structure. Chairperson, thank you very much. When I grow up, I want to speak like Mr. Tonelli. I think I did tell him outside I like his accent.
Oh, your accent.
Let's learn from you how is the homeschooling different from multicultural education in your view? And how is it also different from independent schools? Now, I'm just interested in the case of learners with special education needs. How are they assisted when it comes to? Because I believe some of you would have learners with special education needs. So, how are you dealing with that? And I'm staying in this sense in a child that is blind, that would take a Braille. On top of, we also need a skill that now a person that would understand Braille. And how is that accommodated? But let me just say with you, there is a scenario case here in the country, Dr. Donnelly, in the Eastern Cape, where the parents decided to take their learners, their children, actually they were three, to public schools for grade 1 and 2. Then after that they realized that they want to opt for a homeschooling. Then they homeschooled them from grade 3. Now this year the parents took their kids back to public schools in order for them to get grade 7. Because they started at home to deal with the three of them so that they can move to grade 8. And their response is that, okay, you know, as much as I would want to put it blunt, but I don't want it to come that blunt to you as a race issue. Because they were black parents, right? So they say, no, we took them back to public school because we can't deal with it anymore. In a sense of, you would need tutors, you would need people that specializes in certain subjects, and all those people for three learners now to take care of them, it's a bit expensive. So, it like if it works, then it works for richer communities or richer people. So they have to, then they decided to take their children to public school. Now you have mentioned that in your presentation that the home education is developed by policymakers and it has been done like that for decades. Now in our context here in South Africa there are progressive education policies. In your view, why are home educators not allowing themselves to be regulated under the compliance of the South African National Education Policy? You are saying that this homeschooling is a concept of the United States. Now my question is, here in the country, when do we develop and experience our own model of alternative education? Why ourselves as the country must follow the American way when there is, or there are, other African solutions to our African talented group. After all, we are a diverse society in this country, and that's what it's like with us. You can go to China now, when you land at the airport, everybody speaks Chinese. You can't associate. You feel that you are somewhere else. Everybody, they drink tea. Small cups. They don't drink cold things. Yeah, in South Africa, some of us, when we wake up, we drink black label. Others, we drink, you know, water. Others drink stony. Now, that's South Africa. You know, that's diversity. That's us. And of course, that challenges us and makes us to have different views on how probably should I raise a children that are my children. Right? And now, Doc, I'm asking you specific questions. In America, some states are still following the capital punishment, whereby states have the ability to execute death sentences. Some states do that by means of lethal injection. Now, I am wondering, why is USA as a country agreed to international human rights allow the descent for capital punishment? And yet the country agreed to Universal Declaration of International Human Rights. Because the issue of human rights came very clear and specific in your presentation. You are making reference to homeschooling from the premise of the USA. In addition, you are mentioning the East and the West Africa. Surely, the experiences and historical context of country cannot be the same as the USA. In the East and West Africa, which specific countries is homeschooling implemented? And how is it working? How is it successful? So those are the questions from my side. I'm going to allow then the association to respond.
Madam Chair, I will begin by answering the last question first, which might be a mistake because it's one that I probably should think a little bit more carefully about. But so to clarify, I came here to share two different and separate pieces of information. I am an American. I homeschool my children. I'm very familiar with the American laws and context. I'm an expert on that. Very familiar with the research on U.S., but also some international research, which has grown. And so I wanted to share the American experience with you just from a comparative perspective. Okay? I'm not linking my human rights discussion to the American context, okay? I teach international human rights law, international criminal law. I have an LLM in international human rights law and comparative constitutional law from London School of Economics. Some would say I'm an expert in human rights. I mean, I'm not sure anybody can be an expert in human rights. We're all trying to figure out what human rights are. But supposedly, universal, interdependent, interrelated, and interdivisible. Figure that one out. Okay? I've written journal articles that have been published on that topic. I mean, if somebody says they understand what human rights are, they don't understand what human rights are. Okay? We've got dozens of treaties. I'm just saying context, okay? So I'm separating my comments about the United States and our experience from what I'm talking about in terms of human rights. Okay? So I'm just offering my expertise in the area of human rights to explain how I have seen human rights work and what human rights framework says about education, and I've thought about it in the context of home education, but it's offering that experience to you. You know, I don't have to tell you that the United States is not a signatory to the dozens of human rights treaties that, you know, all the treaties that South Africa has. We're not. The U.S. has not signed the UN Convention on the Rights of the Child, so I'm not trying to put those two things together. I'm not here to defend the United States in the area of human rights. I can explain the Supreme Court's legal reasoning as to why capital punishment is still permitted. I don't think the UDHR says it's not allowed. I guess that would be a question of how you define humane and inhumane. But so just from a very strictly constitutional perspective, and our political system is the Federal Republic, and the states are sovereign entities. There is a shared sovereignty. So we're not a unitary state here. We have provinces, and you have concurrent, and you've assigned certain, as I understand it, some are national, some are provincial, and there's some concurrent. And we do have that a little bit in the U.S. Constitution, but the states are very clearly sovereign entities that retain sovereignty over things that have not been expressly delegated to the federal government or that are not expressly within the Constitution assigned as, you know, their own or potentially concurrent. So we have some idea of concurrent responsibilities also. So with that in mind, what the Supreme Court of the United States has said is simply interpreted the Eighth Amendment of the U.S. Constitution, which prohibits cruel and unusual punishment, and they do so from an originalist perspective, although there are many people who argue that, you know, like the European Court of Human Rights uses dynamic interpretation to take an evolutionary kind of approach to interpreting and defining rights, the Supreme Court of the United States has not done that. So they look to what the Eighth Amendment meant at the time it was ratified in 1789, sorry, and then the Bill of Rights in 1791. Okay, so it'll be 1791 for the Eighth Amendment. And at that time, capital punishment was universally considered normal. And that's it. It's that simple. So what the Supreme Court has said, this is not a federal issue. This is a state issue. This is something that the states have to decide for themselves. I mean, you just saw what happened with the Roe v. Wade decision. The Supreme Court of the United States said, hey, we're not going to deal with this anymore. You guys figure it out. That's the nature of our federal system. So it's different from other countries, but that is the answer to that question. Some states, I think it's 18, maybe it's more than that, maybe 22, states have prohibited capital punishment in theirs, but others have not. And so as a country, our system of government allows states, the Supreme Court has interpreted the Constitution, the Eighth Amendment, to say that's not something that we are going to, you know, federalize. We're not going to say for the whole country, even though they did that with Roe v. Wade for abortion, and then they said, oh, maybe that was a mistake, or we decided we're not going to do that anymore, and they sent it back to the state. So, you know, we have a lot of complexities within our federal system, but as it relates to your specific question on capital punishment, that's the answer. I hope that's interesting, instructive, relevant. I am a defense lawyer.
No follow-up.
You asked me also what specific countries in West and East Africa where homeschooling is happening and how is it working. So in West Africa, Kenya is the country where I would point to, which has a robust home education movement. From a regulatory perspective, it's a little bit of a gray area. The legislature is talking about that right now. They you know, they changed their law in 2012. Before that, you know, homeschooling fell under kind of an exemption, and then they changed their law, and that exemption kind of went away, but homeschooling continued. And so there's a bit of a gray area, so the Kenyan legislators kind of grappling with that right now, trying to figure out, you know, because the homeschoolers are like, hey, you know, we're homeschooling, you know, we'd like to be recognized, you know. And so that's happening in Kenya. Uganda, I'm not sure if they might say they're East Africa, I don't know what you would say about that, but Uganda, there's a growing movement. In West Africa, I've only been to Ghana, and I have some contacts in Nigeria. You know, so it's small there, very small. It's not explicitly recognized in the law. And in a lot of countries, that's the case. There are countries where people do it, and they're allowed to do it, and it's not explicitly recognized in the law. The Constitution will make reference to a family's obligation. You know, some constitutions say, you know, the family is responsible for education. Some say the family and the state are responsible for education. Usually that's the case. I'm not quite sure what the South African Constitution explicitly says about that, although I know what some of the opinions of the members are. But so that would be my answer to that question.
Thank you, Chair. Thank you, Honourable Members. I'm going to try to cover as much as possible. So, Principal, you mentioned that the responsibility of a state is to educate their children. And I would like to say that children only become the ward of a state if parents fail, if families fail. What role is government expected to play in to set up the efficient structures to deal with accusations of education neglect, which can investigate, same as with the other parental issues? The question, why should the curriculum not be standardized? I've got a nice one for you. I'm going to really sort of want to make sure I get it right here. So, curriculum, please. When it goes through the direction of the curriculum, the definition of the education in the United Nations Convention of the Rights of the Child and the African Charter on the Rights and Welfare of the Child, read with Section 89(1) of the Children's Act, places a clear obligation on parents on what the education of their children should be directed to. In practice, it constitutes a macro curriculum, as well as the definition of the ideal citizen. It is submitted that no further direction to parents for the education of their children is needed. Consideration should be given to include this definition indigenized to South Africa in the South African Schools Act. According to the Universal Declaration of Human Rights, education shall be directed to the full development of the human personality. Therefore, it is most important that the education of a child should be determined the unique personality of a child and not by external ideological ideas. Since parents know their children best, they are in the best position to make decisions regarding the curriculum and the approach that a child needs. The preamble in the Constitution of South Africa reads, "We the people of South Africa believe that South Africa belongs to all the living, united in our diversity. Real respect for this diversity must allow for more than a single curriculum. Home education is particularly well suited to accommodate a customized curriculum for each child." Because I know you have some strong thoughts, and you would like to add anything? Yeah, thank you. To me, the diversity of our country is actually what makes us unique and beautiful. South Africa really has got so much rich culture, and my experience is that if people and children are secure in their own values and their own identity, they're easier to embrace and accept others with different opinions and in their own uniqueness. And we see that in the homeschool community often. The homeschool community they easily accept children with special needs, referring to the special needs. We don't, to us,
especially child that may struggle to speak is no different than one that can. They find ways to interact and be together, and I think because they know that their needs are taken for, and I think it's the greatest thing, our children know that they are accepted. They know they're not part of the mainstream school system, and that we often get these strange questions, and they're different, and why are they different, and why are they not following the state curriculum, or some are actually. My own children, their subject is they follow that, and then their subject is they follow the American multi curriculum that comes in America, and then things are within myself, but we do this mix and match, and they know they are different. So for them to embrace other people that are also different is much easier, I think, than many of us. I mean, I grew up where everybody in my school was very much from the same socioeconomic background, spoke the same language, we had common beliefs. My children don't grow up like that. We interact with other people, and that to me is what makes it beautiful. So.
I would like to speak to some of the questions that came up about assessment. I'm one of the homeschoolers. There are many other homeschoolers that also follow a classical model of education. So it's actually a very different approach to education than what the modern model of education follows. And so when it comes to assessment, although we talk about in the modern education system, we talk about grades and phases, in the classical model of education, we also have phases. But our phases of learning are the grammar stage, the dialectic stage, the rhetoric stage, and we have a different way of assessing that. But to have a uniform assessment, a blanket assessment, that would, assess every home schooler in the same way, it doesn't work because our approaches to education are very different. The other question was, why not have a standard of curriculum not be standardized? And I would say one of the things, my family did not start with a classical model of education. We actually started with a very eclectic approach. I pulled from different curriculum. What I found worked for my family was then the classical model. And the reason we made the change was because it just worked better for my family. And homeschool families, they have that option. So you're able to see that your child excels in one area with a certain curriculum and that they struggle in another area. But I'm not married to that decision. I can change. I can keep what works, and I can change what's not working for something that is going to serve my children better. And so that is why we don't want to standardize this is what you'll do, but also why a blanket accreditation is something we're very much against as well. Go ahead, I'll come back to this.
So, regarding mutual borrowing of the education of children, Tikkun Buzu, who spoke from the Gauteng Association, said it very well. So, the education landscape changed fundamentally since 2020. COVID-19 brought disruption and uncertainty, but it also brought a new perspective and opportunities for change. The traditional school system was exposed as fragile and was unable to realize the right to a basic education. Some schools scrambled to devise ways in which to continue to provide a basic education, and Zoom classes, online schools, educational YouTube channels, and tutoring apps came to school. Others had to change the rules and have to be able to catch up when the situation improved. An education, on the other hand, with its flexible curricula and the graduates could weather the storm and with a few quick adaptations continue to provide learners with a basic education. It was the innovations tried and tested for distance learning and home education that proved to be anti-fragile and provide solutions in turbulent times. Therefore, home education as an incubator for innovation and improvement should not be tied and restricted to fit into the traditional school system, merely for the convenience of administrators. Formal consultation bodies ought to the draft or to draft regulations that consider how to scan home education and emerging educational modalities so that we can benefit more learners. We have to define and distinguish the criteria for different modalities. Diversity, equity and inclusion education, and also dealing with budget constraints. So the pandemic changed the education landscape drastically, but Barrable should adapt to this. Whilst the traditional school system was not able to realize the right to basic education during these disruptive events, home education, online schools and emerging educational modalities was able to continue with little to no disruption. It is vital that our system should adapt to support learners in a changing world. To make an education system that thrives during disruptions part of a system that struggles to adapt to almost insurmountable difficulties and was fundamentally disruptive is not reasonable.
I just wanted to speak to, I wanted to answer the question about